So, in structural engineering, there's this concept called a load path.
Oh, right. Like how weight gets distributed.
Yeah, exactly. Like when you look at a suspension bridge, you don't really have to guess how the weight of the cars transfers to the cables and, down to the towers and eventually into the bedrock.
Right, because the path is physical. You can literally see it.
Exactly. It's visible and it's totally governed by the laws of physics. If an engineer makes a mistake, the math basically exposes it long before the concrete is even poured.
You can point to the exact spot where it's going to fail. The physical world kind of forces this rigorous transparency on you.
But then, you step into the world of business critical software deployments, especially at the enterprise level, and suddenly that visible load path just completely vanishes.
Oh, completely. It's all invisible dependencies from there on out.
Right. We're dealing with these hidden structural links. So, like, a massive database upgrade in one department quietly fractures a reporting tool in another department. And nobody realizes the foundation is crumbling until the entire system just locks up on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, it's pretty much the equivalent of building a skyscraper, where the steel beams like magically change their physical properties depending on who happens to be looking at them.
Huh, yeah. That is exactly what it feels like. And navigating that invisible complexity is exactly why you're joining us for today's deep dive.
We are getting into some really dense but incredibly important stuff today.
Yeah, we are unpacking a highly specific, aggressively practical guide. It's titled Release Management Checklist for Business Critical Software in 2026.
And we really need to filter this through the current landscape that companies are facing right now, right?
Yeah.
Because the text heavily anchors us in the realities of businesses operating in Orange County and the broader Southern California region.
Which is such a specific but relevant market. Oh, absolutely. Leaders in these markets are making tech decisions under just a suffocating amount of pressure right now. Budgets are fundamentally different today than they were a few years ago.
Oh, for sure.
Like the era of cheap capital funding these endless experimental tech initiatives, that's completely over. Security expectations are punishingly high.
Yeah, and executive boards have zero appetite for vendor promises at this point. They're demanding, verifiable empirical evidence before they greenlight any major systemic overhaul.
Okay, let's unpack this because our core mission today is to show you that this source text is absolutely not a traditional IT manual.
No, not at all. It's definitely more of a strategic playbook for leadership.
Right. It is designed to act as this friction-inducing mechanism. It actually forces organizations to like slow down their tech decisions just enough to expose the hidden risks.
To compare their options objectively.
Exactly. And to avoid purchasing a platform that looks revolutionary in some, polished slide deck, but then just turns into an operational black hole 6 months after launch.
Well, we really have to start by analyzing the behavior that leads a company to this document in the first place. I mean, a phrase like release management checklist, that is not a proactive search term.
No, definitely not something you just Google for fun.
Right. Like a high-functioning, heavily optimized tech department is not casually browsing for this on a Tuesday morning. When this query actually hits a search engine, it indicates an organization in acute distress.
Yeah, they are reacting to a bleeding wound. They have this operational gap that has basically finally become too expensive to ignore.
Exactly. And the guide points out that these teams are usually suffering from a really specific cocktail of failures. It's usually unclear internal ownership, massive gaps in documentation, or just agonizingly slow vendor response times.
Or they suddenly realize their entire tech stack is held together by the heroic efforts of like one or two overworked
Which
engineers.
is so common. And so they're looking for a checklist to basically impose some sort of order on the chaos.
But the guide issues this massive warning right at the very top, because the instinct in that moment of crisis is to just buy a new tool to fix the chaos.
Yes. What the text calls the tool first trap. We see this constantly.
Constantly. Like a company realizes their sales data is messy, right? So they immediately go buy this massive, complex new CRM platform. They assume the software itself will, I don't know, magically force their sales team to become disciplined data entry clerks.
Which fundamentally misunderstands the actual mechanism of the failure. The software is really just an amplifier.
Exactly.
I mean, if you have a broken, undefined internal process, deploying a huge new platform will only allow you to execute that broken process at a much faster, more expensive scale.
It's like buying a software tool before you define the business outcome is like buying a high-end sports car just because the salesperson said it was really fast.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Right. But then you get it home and you realize your actual business need was like a dump truck to haul gravel. The sports car doesn't help you at all.
Yeah, you're just hauling gravel in a Ferrari. It's going to end badly. So before a single contract is signed, leaders have to document the current state and actually define the exact business outcome they want.
Right. Like, are you trying to reduce customer onboarding time? Or are you trying to lower your cloud computing costs by 20%?
Exactly. You have to define that operational metric first, and then you work backward to see if your data structures, your employee handoffs, and your existing integrations can even support that kind of change.
And defining that business outcome, it forces a much more uncomfortable conversation, doesn't it, about accountability?
Oh, big time. Because if you are going to deploy a system to fix a problem, you have to establish exactly who is on the hook if the problem remains unfixed.
Which nobody ever wants to do.
Nope. But the source material is relentless on this point. It repeats these four guiding questions over and over, demanding that they be asked at every single phase of the deployment.
Wait, okay, what are the four questions?
So first, what evidence supports the recommendation? And that means empirical data, not just what the marketing materials say.
Right, show me the actual numbers.
Second, who owns the outcome after launch? Third, what risks must be mitigated before implementation even begins? And fourth, how will success be measured at the 30, 60, and 90-day marks?
That second question, the ownership one, that seems to be where most software deployments just silently fail.
It absolutely is. The guide outlines this really rigid internal ownership model.
Mm-hmm.
It requires four distinct roles to basically maintain the tension that you need for a successful rollout.
Right. So you have an executive sponsor, a business owner, a technical owner, and an operational reviewer.
Exactly. And the dynamic, the sort of friction between those roles, is where the magic actually happens.
Because they all want different things.
Right. The business owner's primary directive is all about ROI and speed to market. They want the software out there driving revenue yesterday.
But the technical owner is looking at the system architecture. Like, their directive is stability, security, and making sure the code is clean.
Right. And if the business owner overpowers the technical owner, you get this system that launches on time, sure, but it crashes constantly because it was built on a massive foundation of technical debt.
But then if the technical owner overpowers the business owner, you end up with this like beautifully architected, flawless piece of software that takes 3 years to build and totally misses the market window.
Exactly. It's a balancing act. And then you have the operational reviewer who basically acts as the reality check for both of those people.
Yeah. They're the one in the room saying, hey, this looks amazing on paper, but if you force our frontline staff to click through 7 different screens just to log a single customer call, they are simply going to bypass the system entirely.
Spot on. And while all of this is happening, the executive sponsor sits above that friction, armed with the actual budget and the authority to break ties and remove institutional blockers.
Let me push back on this a little bit on behalf of our listener, because if you are tuning in from, say, a mid-sized firm or a lean startup, you probably don't have 4 redundant executives just sitting around waiting to be assigned to a single software release.
Oh, definitely not.
You might have a total leadership team of like 3 people.
What's fascinating here is how the source material actually anticipates that exact constraint. The guide is very clear that these are roles. They are not necessarily headcounts.
Okay, so one person can wear multiple hats.
Exactly. In a lean organization, the technical owner and the operational reviewer might be the exact same person. But the key is that the responsibilities themselves cannot be merged or just ignored. That friction must be maintained.
So you can't just, you know, throw everyone in a random Slack channel and assume the ownership will just sort itself out organically.
Because it won't. When accountability is diffused across a whole group, it effectively drops to zero. Without a visible name attached to the technical feasibility and a completely different visible name attached to the business outcome, the momentum of the project will just collapse.
Yeah, the moment they hit their first major technical hurdle, everyone just scatters.
Exactly.
But I mean, defining those internal roles means absolutely nothing if the external vendor you hire simply bypasses them to go tell the CEO whatever they want to hear.
That is such a huge problem.
Right. So how we evaluate the vendor, the people actually selling and building the software, that's the next major pillar of this text.
And the guide proposes what they call a 2026 Ready Vendor Scorecard, because we're moving far beyond a standard request for proposal here.
Yeah, you don't just ask a vendor, hey, can you build this feature?
No, you demand to see their actual internal workflow diagrams. You have to evaluate their security posture, their implementation quality, and really dig into the deep mechanics of their ongoing support model.
You are basically interviewing them on their risk tolerance. Like, when a vendor is pitching you, you shouldn't ask them to just outline their best case scenario. You need to ask them about their discovery process.
Yes. You need them to detail the specific risks they anticipate based on your company's specific legacy systems.
And ask them what specific conditions would cause them to halt the implementation. Like, what makes them hit the brakes?
Because a mature, trustworthy vendor will actively narrow the scope of a project to ensure that initial launch is successful. They will actually push back against feature creep.
Whereas a desperate vendor will just agree to every customized request you throw at them, which drastically inflates the risk profile just because they want to close the deal.
Absolutely. And the warning signs are glaring if you know where to look.
Yeah.
Vague scope documents, evasive answers regarding their own internal access controls, or, you know, a pricing model that conveniently buries all the post-launch maintenance costs.
Oh, man. Yeah. But the scorecard criteria that really stands out to me is the demand for what they call exit readiness.
Right. Protecting the organization against vendor lock-in.
It's basically a corporate prenuptial agreement. It requires forcing a highly uncomfortable conversation. You're sitting down with this brand new partner. The ink on the contract isn't even dry yet. And you have to demand a detailed roadmap of exactly how you will extract your data and fire them in the future.
It sounds so awkward, but we have to look at the actual mechanics of data gravity. Vendors design their systems to make data ingestion incredibly seamless, right? They want your data.
Yeah, they pull it right in.
But extracting that data, mapping it back out into some kind of usable format, and transferring the administrative rights back to you, that is often made structurally complex on purpose. It is a subtle retention strategy.
Yeah, if you do not demand the data export schemas, the code ownership definitions, and the transition SLAs right up front, you lose all of your leverage.
Every ounce of it.
Because the vendor knows it will eventually cost you more to leave than to endure their declining service quality, so you just become trapped in their ecosystem.
Which is exactly why the guide considers it a critical failure if a vendor cannot clearly articulate that exit plan from day one. And that same level of rigor applies to how they articulate the initial launch, too.
Oh, for sure. If a vendor cannot walk you through the precise metrics of the first 90 days post-launch, the project is fundamentally unready.
Which actually transitions us into the reality of implementation. The text advocates heavily for a really rigid 30-60-90-day success plan to prevent these deployments from turning into those multi-year budget-draining zombie projects.
The time frame really forces discipline. Like days 0 through 30, those are purely diagnostic. You map the current state, you confirm the technical dependencies, and you isolate the single most critical operational gap.
Right, you aren't building a single thing yet.
Zero code is written.
Then days 30 through 60, focus on piloting the solution targeted strictly at that one specific gap. You prove the value on a microscopic scale.
Okay, and then?
Finally, days 60 through 90 are for analyzing the pilot's empirical data and making a definitive, documented decision to either scale the deployment, pivot the strategy, or just kill the project entirely.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The text insists that the specific metrics for that 90-day decision, whether it's a reduction in server downtime, faster API response rates, or a higher volume of process leads, those metrics must be locked in before day zero.
They have to be.
Yeah.
Because if you wait until day 90 to define what success looks like, you fall victim to confirmation bias.
Oh, human nature totally takes over.
It does. Human nature will compel a team to just scour the data, find any metric that happened to improve over the last 3 months, and retroactively declare the whole project a massive success.
The sunk cost fallacy kicks in hard. Nobody wants to stand up and tell the board they just spent $500,000 on a pilot that totally failed. So they highlight the fact that user login speeds increased by 10%, conveniently ignoring that the primary goal was actually supposed to be a 30% reduction in data entry errors.
Defining the metrics up front removes the emotional component of the evaluation. But even with airtight metrics, I mean, the implementation phase is just a minefield.
Yeah.
The guide actually flags the parallel workflow trap as one of the most dangerous yet common mistakes companies make.
Oh, this happens all the time. This is when leadership deploys the new software, but they allow the legacy system to remain fully operational right alongside it.
Yeah.
And it is usually done under the guise of, you know, providing a safety net for the staff.
But the psychological mechanism at play there completely dooms the new system. We are dealing with cognitive load and risk aversion at the individual contributor level here.
Right, because an employee's performance and often their actual compensation is tied directly to their efficiency.
Exactly. They know exactly how to navigate that clunky old system to get their job done quickly. They have all the workarounds memorized.
Yeah, but the new system, no matter how objectively superior it might be, it requires them to be slow and feel incompetent for a few weeks while they learn it.
Right, and if the old system is still sitting right there on their desktop, they will invariably revert back to it just to maintain their productivity metrics. The parallel workflow suffocates adoption.
So leadership has to aggressively sever the cord. Just cut it.
They had to.
I do want to challenge the pacing of this framework, though. Like, a 90-day plan is a fantastic forcing function, sure. But if we are talking about tearing out the core operating system of a massive enterprise-level company expecting meaningful structural change in 90 days, borders on the impossible.
Oh, it would absolutely be impossible if the goal was a full global rollout. But the source mitigates this through a phased implementation roadmap.
Oh, okay.
The 90-day framework applies exclusively to the initial pilot.
Yeah.
It's a hyper-focused, heavily controlled slice of the business. You isolate a single department or maybe just a single geographic region.
Right, you contain the blast radius.
Precisely. You move incredibly fast in that one isolated environment to basically stress test all your assumptions. If the architecture is going to buckle, you want it to buckle in a pilot affecting 50 users, not during a global launch affecting 5,000 people.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But even when you're moving fast in a contained pilot, there are two massive blind spots that companies routinely ignore, mainly because they don't produce immediate visible ROI, and those are security and documentation.
Let's talk about security first. In the 2026 landscape, isolating security to just the IT department or just the core database is a fatal error.
Every single tech procurement is a security decision now.
It has to be. The text uses marketing software as a prime example, which is actually brilliant.
Yeah, because a business leader might naturally assume a tool used to just send out email newsletters or track website clicks doesn't really require a rigorous security audit.
But that marketing tool requires administrative credentials. It ingests massive amounts of proprietary customer behavior data, and it often requires direct API integrations into your core CRM just to function properly.
Right, so if a threat actor compromises the weak access controls of that peripheral marketing tool, they can basically use those trusted API pathways to quietly siphon data right out of the main database.
Exactly. Leaders have to demand the exact same level of logging, incident escalation protocols, and access control validation for a random HR scheduling app as they do for their main financial ledgers.
And that level of ongoing security management is literally impossible without addressing the second blind spot, obsessive documentation.
Yes.
Because the guide treats documentation not as some boring administrative chore, but as the primary defensive shield for the company's operational knowledge.
We see so many teams treat documentation as a post-mortem activity. They always promise they will write down how the system works once the launch is completely finished.
Which practically guarantees it will never be done.
Never. The team will be totally exhausted, and they will immediately be reassigned to the next burning fire.
It's like spending a month building this incredibly complex Lego set, but you're just making it up as you go, and then you throw away any notes you took immediately after.
Oh, yeah.
The danger is that without proactive documentation, like decision logs, workflow diagrams, and exact configuration settings, you are essentially forcing your future employees into software archaeology.
That's exactly what it is. Because 2 years from now, that lead engineer who built the integration, they leave for another company. The system inevitably breaks.
And the remaining team has to painstakingly reverse engineer the code just to understand why certain architectural decisions were even made in the first place before they can even begin to fix it.
Thorough documentation is the mechanism that separates the institutional knowledge from the individual employee. It is the only thing that protects the company's investment against inevitable turnover.
And it also heavily impacts the true budget. I mean, the initial estimate a vendor provides on a sales call is virtually never the total cost of ownership.
Rarely. A low initial estimate almost always omits the vital, unglamorous work. A realistic budget actually has to account for the deep discovery phase, exhaustive quality assurance testing, user training, third-party security audits, and that ongoing support model required when the system inevitably requires patching.
Yeah, it adds up fast. So if a mid-market firm in Southern California is listening to this, analyzing their own systems, and realizing they are, frankly, utterly unequipped to manage this level of vendor scrutiny, documentation, and phased rollout strategy, well, the text actually offers a highly specific operational off-ramp.
It does. The guide synthesizes its recommendations by pointing to consulting partners who actually specialize in operationalizing this exact kind of friction.
Right.
For organizations in Orange County and the surrounding regions, the text highlights Technigian. And they're introduced not just as another software vendor, but as a strategic partner specifically equipped to execute this framework.
They step in to map that undocumented current state, conduct the baseline audits, and build the actual phased 90-day roadmap. Whether a company is looking to optimize a sprawling Microsoft 365 environment, or they need to vet a custom software deployment, a partner like Technigian forces the necessary questions to be asked.
They establish the visible ownership, they mandate the security reviews, and they ensure that the business outcome remains the absolute driving force behind the technical execution.
And for leaders looking to understand the broader sort of global metrics driving these strategies, the guide directs teams to deeply analytical repositories like Dora.dev.
Right. Dora metrics are basically the industry standard for measuring DevOps performance. They provide the empirical benchmarks for things like deployment frequency and change failure rates, which really gives teams a way to measure their agility against top-tier tech organizations globally.
The text also points to learn.microsoft.com, which is crucial for teams needing access to validated enterprise-grade architectural frameworks rather than just blindly relying on a vendor's proprietary untested design.
It gives them a solid foundation to work from.
So what does this all mean? If we synthesize everything for you, the listener, a release management checklist is not just an administrative formality. It is a vital mechanism of control. It replaces the illusion of a polished sales pitch with a measurable, verifiable process that actually protects your data, your budget, and honestly, your team's operational sanity.
It forces you to build the load path before you pour the concrete.
Exactly. I love that. And before we close out this deep dive, we want to leave you with a final thought to kind of mull over on your own, extending the logic of the source material into the immediate future.
Yeah, so we spent a lot of time discussing how documentation is the ultimate insurance policy against human turnover, right?
Right. Making sure the knowledge stays with the company.
Ensuring the knowledge of how a system operates stays with the business, not the departing employee. But as we move deeper into an era where AI begins writing its own operational code and, you know, dynamically adjusting system configurations on the fly and even self-patching security vulnerabilities, the system itself becomes the sole entity that truly understands how its own architecture works.
Wow, yeah. The software essentially becomes the most knowledgeable employee in the room.
Exactly. So the question becomes, when the AI is the only thing that truly understands the load path, how does a human executive actually enforce ownership of the outcome?
Oh, man. That is a structural challenge that absolutely no checklist has solved yet.
Not yet.
We'll leave you to think about that one. Until next time, keep digging deeper.